Well, first of all, as my wife aptly said, Heath, make sure you say thank you before you forget. So, thank you. You guys have, over the years, blessed us upon blessed us upon blessed us upon blessed us. And I just wanted to extend my heartfelt thanks to you, because you need to know that the people that I have the privilege to walk with, they wouldn't have me there walking with them if it weren't for you. So I want to acknowledge that right out of the gate. If you have Bibles with you, which I'm sure you do, because some of you are still analog, would you turn with me to Acts chapter 14? Now, this is going to be a weird, it's going to be less sermony and more storytelly because of this verse. I have the privilege of leading a Bible study on Vancouver's downtown east side. Can you imagine like 25 people of all states of, you know, neurodivergent, drug addiction, and then there's me, which I fit right in. And we have so much fun going, looking at the Bible together. And we've been going through the book of Acts. And we've just finished Acts chapter 14. And I thought it was very appropriate that we ended here. And then I get to speak to you today. So Acts chapter 14, starting at verse 26 to 28. So Paul has just finished with Barnabas his first missionary journey. And he's headed back to Antioch. And they sailed from there to Antioch, where they had been commended to the grace of God for the work which they have fulfilled. So Antioch sent them out. They're coming back home. And when they arrived and gathered the church together, they declared all that God has done with them and how he had opened a door of faith to the Gentiles. And they remained no little time there with the disciples. This is a privilege. I have the joy to be able to share with you all that God has done in and on the downtown east side for the last couple of years. And it's quite a roller coaster, let me tell you. There's an earworm. You know, you've heard of like earworm songs, right? They get in your brain and it's just like they're on repeat. I had the joy of like moving grandkids. So I've been listening to like Fred Penner on repeat for like a while. And so this is not like Fred Penner, but there's a quote by a South American theologian. And it's a bit of an earworm for me. I would say like a mind worm. And the quote is this, as how does God say to the poor, I love you? How does God say to the poor, I love you? But more specifically, to my context, how does God say to those struggling in addiction, I love you? How does God say to those who are dealing with the struggle of mental illness day in and day out? How does God say to them, I love you? How does God say to the men and women who are struggling to make ends meet, who are living out of their car? I know a lady that lives with her daughter in a motorhome in my neighborhood. How does God say to them, I love you? How does God say to my friend who stands on the street corner outside of my house and sells herself to make ends meet? How does God say to her, I love you? How does God say to my other friend who, when I open the door and tinker on my motorcycle, because I have the privilege of that, and when he's in the food lineup for UGM, how does God say to him, he was a child soldier in Sudan, how does God say to him, I love you? And I think the answer is simple but not simplistic, and you know it. It's incarnation. But it's incarnation, not just being present, but actually being present in love. Now, one can say, there's a metaphor, people ask me, Heath, what do you do? And of course, because I am who I am, and I'm like, squirrel brains. I got seven plates in the air spinning all at the same time. So this is the best way to describe what I do, to give you a kind of a guiding metaphor, so to speak. Some of you may or may not have watched NASCAR. Probably didn't think I was going to go there, did you? So how does one, you know, racing cars is an expensive thing, right? So how does one actually do that? You need sponsorships. And so you got one NASCAR, and you've got 38 different sponsorship stickers on it. So that's more or less my job. I have one thing that I do, and I've got lots of sponsorship stickers on it. So on the downtown, he said, I'll give you a bit of an overview to remind you, and then we'll get into some nitty-gritty of what's been happening. I have the joy of volunteering at Union Gospel Mission. I act as a chaplain for some of the men in their transitional housing, and I get the joy of walking through with some of them. Like one of my friends, He got baptized a couple years ago. I had the joy of baptizing him. And then he relapses, and then he relapses, and then he relapses. And he sits on my front porch in full relapse mode after he'd, you know, spent a couple of days on a bender. And he says, Heath, is my baptism still valid? That's the privilege that I have. And I hug him in his filth, and I say, oh, man. This is why I have every one of my guys memorize 1 John chapter 2. So as I say, hey, remember that verse? My dear little children, I'm writing these things to you that you may not sin. But if you do, you have the righteous one, Jesus Christ, the propitiation for not only our sins, but for the sins of the whole world. And he's like, so ask him. So, Mark, is your baptism valid? He's like, yeah, I know, Heath. But it's shame. So I have the joy of walking through guys in that. I also have the joy of doing Bible studies for morning meditation. So guys in recovery, they're a fun lot. And so my thing is, like, how do I actually give them something to take home? Because, you know, they're required to sit in there. So there's like 40 of them sitting in there. A third of them maybe have faith. And so what I've been doing, and I haven't gotten fired yet, so this is a good thing, I've been telling Old Testament Bible stories with all of the ugly bits put back in. So we sanitize all those stories. And if you read the Old Testament, there's a lot of nasty stuff in there. And so my whole goal with these guys is to say, if God can use this person, we call him a hero. We call her a hero. If God can use these people, just maybe he could use you. Just maybe he can use you. I also have the joy to volunteer as a chaplain at Jacob's Well. I'm on staff there, and I get the privilege of cooking food on Wednesdays and leading a Bible study, which I'll describe a little bit later. And I get the joy of walking through people's lives. They're good things, they're bad things. And, you know, sometimes if you work in, some of you, if you're in the medical industry, you get only to see people on their worst days, right? I have the joy of seeing the good days, the bad days, and all the in-between days, and it's a real treasure. In fact, I get the joy of walking with one of my friends who the other day was quite angry with me. In fact, he cursed me out using lots of expletives multiple times as I was giving out hamburgers because he was late and he missed the hamburger. And then the next breath, he phones me and apologizes. And then the next day, I help him with his e-bike because he can't figure out his throttle control. And that's what it means, is being present with all of the chaos that ensues in people's lives. Another thing that I do is I get the joy, and this is where Kiara and Jordan kind of fit in, I get the joy of, with an organization called Message Trust, of training and equipping men and women to do what I do, to work in difficult neighborhoods. Because let me tell you, the Vancouver's downtown east side is like maybe the tip of the spear, but I know every single one of you here this morning, you're either homeless adjacent, in other words, you know somebody in your sphere that's homeless. You're mentally ill adjacent. You know somebody that struggles with a lot of stuff in your family, in your friend sphere. And I know many of you, even like this morning, like we're addiction adjacent. We have people in our lives that are struggling. So I happen to have the privilege of seeing everybody from all of our neighborhoods come to my neighborhood. But the fact is that I want to mutually encourage, like, not as all lost, but you need to be equipped like I. So I get the joy of equipping men and women to work in other neighborhoods. But all of these things, I do all of these crazy things, all these plates spinning in the air is for one reason and one reason only, and that's been Urban Chapel. And it seems like it's been a church plant a la molasses mode, right? I've been probably saying this to you for years now. Partly because I have ADHD, and if I don't slow things down, I just won't do it. So I'm slowing it down to a rate in which I can actually accomplish things. And secondly, I can't go faster because I get ahead of the neighborhood. So Urban Chapel has been a six-year burn in my mind. In other words, a six-year idea that's slowly come to fruition. And I do all of the things that I do in the neighborhood, just maybe. I've got this idea, is how does God say to the people, I love you? It's not a ministry serving food. No, it's a church. It's a church because if you treat the downtown east side like a problem to solve, which what my government, your government, my city does, then people become problems to solve, not people who need to see Jesus. So the onus is on us to actually contextualize that Jesus so they can hear, see, understand, respond, and grow. So in that, Urban Chapel is an idea I cooked up. I just imagine a Navy SEAL team, an SAS team, good morning, welcome. Oh, don't be sorry. It's all good. Imagine a crazy Navy SEAL team, highly specialized, highly equipped. You're slightly off your rocker to do the crazy things you got to do. You're brave. You're willing to kind of like operate a little bit outside the parameters of like normal church structure, and you're able to actually be present in a way in people's lives. So I thought, what if I take and build a team like that, but then I couple it to a rhythm that is stationary, that's permanent. Almost like if you remember back into the Middle Ages, if you remember church history, a monastic rhythm. The monasteries, we could talk a lot about it, but we won't get into the Catholic end of it. But just think, the monasteries provided education to those in the Middle Ages that had no education. The monasteries provided a place of housing and hospitality for those that had none. The monastery provided a place of stability and employment for people who were unemployable. And the monastery provided a construct of faith for people to actually grow. So I thought, what if I take a crazy SAS team or a Navy SEAL team and I couple this with a monastic rhythm? That might be Urban Chapel. And my elders decided, hey, that's a crazy enough idea, and you're the kind of guy that to do it. So that's what I've been up to. And I've been test driving it in my Bible study on Thursday night at Jacob's Well. See, I used the Bible study to test drive ideas. So I began to think, what would it look like for people to interact into church? So I started bringing guys in from the recovery program in addiction into my normal church setting, if I want to use the word normal, and they had a hard time connecting. They didn't get invited out for hospitality to meals. They were hard connecting. Like, if you've got a guy, I've got a guy that I walk with that's on the sex offender list, how does he integrate into your home group fellowship? It's hard, isn't it? And so I began to think, what if we, instead of thinking in terms of how people can interact in that church setting, what if we flip it on its head and think in terms of social flexibility, and maybe let's create a structure that allows socially inflexible people to feel comfortable and have the quote-unquote normal people interact in that, and let's see how things work. And that's been a fun thing to have experimented in the last couple of years. And one of your own has actually helped me. Ellie Hansen has been great. She's helped me to figure out what, you know, liturgy can look like and singing. And let's just say, a lot of people love to sing songs. So basically, our worship looks like karaoke-style song singing. So we sing Amazing Grace to the tune of House of Rising Sun. Yeah, I know. We almost need to close with that. But anyway, so I began to think in these sort of terms, and then with the structure of the Bible study, this gives you an overview of understanding how I'm thinking. On a regular Sunday morning church, we have maybe one sermon, right, and it's out of a specific text, and then maybe if you have a midweek, you'll look at that text and maybe look at what that text was, and then the next week you go on to the next. What happens if you've got different types of learning styles? So what I've done is I've developed a structure where the first week, we've been going through the book of Acts now for a year, which is gets you an idea how slow it is. But for the first week, we look, hey, what does this text actually mean for the context and the time and when it was written? So we exegete the text, right? The second week, we maybe look at this text and go, okay, that what it meant there, that theme, what does it actually mean for us now? And it's so much fun. So we've been looking at the book of Acts, think about this, with the lens of power dynamics. How did the early church interact with power? And it's been a fascinating dialogue. And so they think, okay, this is what it means. This is what it means for us. And this is the key part right here. We ground it in an actionable item. So the next week, we come back and we think, okay, this is what it meant. This is what it meant for us. Is there something we can actually do to ground that? And then we plan an event, and then we do it, and we evaluate it, and then we rinse and repeat. And let me tell you, I'll tell you Mo's story. Mo came to us. He's from a Punjabi background, came to Canada when he was 9. His parents decided to go to of all things, a Jehovah's Witness congregation. And at 9 years old in Canada, trying to learn English, he saw the abusive nature of his father and mother's relationship, and he came to the front for prayer and prayed, God, if you're real, you will stop Dad beating Mom. Well, 50 years later, he's on the downtown east side. And the first time I met Mo is a character. First time I met Mo, he had swashbuckling boots on. You ever seen Pirates of the Caribbean? Okay. He had swashbuckling boots on. He had baggy pants on. He had a long leather trench coat on. He had a hat, a cowboy hat that he'd pinned up to make it look like Jack Sparrow. And he had a stuffed parrot on his shoulder. And his nickname is Slow-Mo, and this is how he walks. A couple years ago, he went on a bit of a bender, and he passed out when we had a real cold snap, and he lost 7 toes. So now he's really Slow-Mo. We called him the two-toed sloth, but anyway, that's a whole other story. He calls himself that, so it's okay. The point is this. When I first met him, interacting in the Bible study 5 years ago, he would dominate. He would argue. He wasn't a Christian. He would be vitriolic. And we actually, at the Bible study, we'd have an old school, like, primary thing. We'd if you hold the pen, you get to speak. 2 weeks ago, I had him close in prayer at the Bible study, and he thanked God, his creator, in Jesus for saving his life. It just takes time. It takes time and different ways to learn. See, we've got this performance thing. If somebody comes to faith, we think that by a certain time they should be here, right? Well, in reality, for a lot of people, it's down here. Because when people don't measure up here, we don't know what to do with them. So I want to create a structure that allows people to flourish in this zone. Because in some ways, I've learned so much more from all of my friends on the downtown east side than, it's a privilege to be able to walk alongside with them. So for the last 6-8 months, I've been praying 2 things. One is venue. And we raised a bunch of money at Christmas time, and that was going to be some seed money to beta test more ideas for Urban Chapel, but essentially a church structure for every day of the week. And as I began to look, I'm like, prices of venues have started to increase. See, they're putting a new St. Paul's Hospital on the other side of the neighborhood, and that's causing more gentrification at a faster rate. And so my budget, it was like $6,000 to $8,000 a month for rent for a venue for like 12 to 2,500 square feet. And as I began looking in January, February, March, April, places that are rat infested are going for $10,000 to $12,000 a month rent. And it was discouraging, banging my head against the wall. Like, you're trying to do something in a level of unsustainability, and then you got to think about 10 grand a month. Very discouraged. So in the Bible study, we've been going through Acts. And there was a text in Acts chapter 12, where you can turn there if you want. I won't read it, but I'll tell it. Herod grabs James, kills him by the sword. And then he grabs Peter, and he thinks, oh, he saw the crowd, it pleased the crowd, so he's going to kill Peter as well. And so what does the church do? It's quite profound. The church doesn't bust him, doesn't have a jailbreak. They don't have elaborate strategies. No, they went on their knees and they prayed. They prayed big, bold prayers. And then the funny thing is, it makes me have hope, is in that, when Peter gets released miraculously, they don't believe it. They think he's some sort of ghost or apparition. And it gives me hope, because sometimes I lack faith just like that. And so as I began to pray, Lord, give me a team, because team is essential for sustainability. A team like Kiara and Jordan are raising their own funds to be able to work with us on the downtown east side. This incarnation in love, I've coined a term, it's like downward mobility. You know, I've heard of upward mobility. It's purposely being downwardly mobile for the sake of the other. That's a hard call in probably the most expensive city in Canada. And so, in that, we've had some answers to prayer. So, if you could cue the video, we'll roll this. Because, yeah, I'll just let it speak for itself. And now you can just make yourself comfortable. It's weird. I preach sometimes at a theater in one of our other churches, and when you get ready to preach, it's weird to hear all the people reclining back in their chairs. But anyway, go ahead. I have been on the downtown east side for about 5 years now. I'm here as an urban chaplain. Really what that means is I have the privilege to walk alongside of my friends.
people who are in all sorts of various conditions, life stages, and I have the joy to pastor outside the gates of the church. For the past 6 months, we've been looking for a place for Urban Chapel, a venue, a place where we can pray together, worship together, and read the Word of God together. In all of my searching, I had closed door after closed door after closed door. And then I heard of an opportunity to purchase 543 Powell Street. And this place happens to be the home of Jacob's Well.
At its core, Jacob's Well is a place of welcome. It's this very simple idea that if we will create room in our lives for connection through friendship, transformation is possible. Jacob's Well's greatest strength has always been relationships and friendship. We've also always had the fear that we will lose space. This relationship with Christ City offers Jacob's Well the opportunity to continue consistency of presence in a place that we have called home. On the other hand, it offers Christ City the possibility of joining in the welcome through Jacob's Well and extending the table into what will be Urban Chapel. More room for deep friendship and ultimately deep transformation.
Over the last few months, we've been praying for and looking for the right space and location for our Urban Chapel. And this really feels like an answer to those prayers, with these two ministries having the opportunity to work in the same building, side by side, in different ways, for the good of the downtown east side. Back in May, when this opportunity came up, we decided as elders to make an offer to purchase this building for $1.45 million. And that offer was accepted pending congregational approval. As such, we are going to have a special members meeting on July 14th, where we're going to share more details about the purchase, about the partnership, and about the capital campaign that, if approved, we will be launching on that day. So if you are a member of one of our Christ City churches or a regular attender, would you join us on July 14th as we step forward in faith into what we believe God is doing in this neighborhood?
The purchase of 543 Powell Street is a wonderful opportunity. It gives us the direct incarnation, the embodiment in this neighborhood that I have been looking for the past 6 months. I am so excited about this opportunity to create a space that extends the welcome of Jesus to all who call the downtown east side home.
Obviously, that's pretty specific to our church. So when I get home, we have a members meeting, and Lord willing, they will accept it, and then we raise a bit of funds. 2,700 square feet at 1.45 million, fun times. But you know, my challenge to you is to pray big, bold prayers with me. Not only for Urban Chapel, but for your community. I know there's stuff that goes on here that seems impossible. So I want you not only to be praying for us, but as I pray for you, pray that God would do a transformative work in your community. Now, that leads us to our second prayer request, is that's team. It's a huge ask. Sustainability is not just financial. It's about people's mental, emotional, and spiritual health as they minister to some of the most difficult situations around. And so in that, I've been on loop in my own prayer journal, prayer life, working through the Ascent Psalms. And when Urban Chapel was... when we first presented the Urban Chapel for an option to buy the 543 Powell Street, I would like to turn, if you have your Bibles, turn to Psalm 127, and I would like to read that for us, because it's an answer to prayer on two different levels. And so I've been just reading the Ascent Psalms over and over and over and over and over again in this season. So Psalm 127, I'll be reading from the English Standard Version. It says... this is attributed to Solomon. It says, "Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is in vain that you rise up early and go to late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb are reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man whose quiver is who fills his quiver with them. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate. Now, I always, you know, you get the first bit, right? But like, what's with the quiver, arrow, family? And then it dawned on me the morning that I read this, Kiara and Jordan were on a call and they're like, Dad, we've been working on a gig to maybe work in a different area of Burnaby, Edmonds. And they're like, Dad, we just want to work with you on the downtown east side. And this struck home deep for me. This isn't just procreation. This is about lasting work, building with your family. And sometimes, and I'm like, I had to wrap my mind around that. And then I remembered. I sent Kiara to Bible school. I'm not really hoping she'd find a husband, but I was probably wondering what would happen if. And as I began teaching classes on missions and evangelism, I was, you know, I watched this one clown, his name was Jordan, and he'd be running around, and I watched him, because I saw something in him. Close your ears, Jordan, you don't want to hear this. I saw something in him that you just don't see very often. A tenacity for the gospel, a flexibility to work with people in difficult circumstances. This kid's like 20 years old, and he's helping out with a church plant in Chase. Like, what 20-year-old does that? And so I watched him, and I watched him, and he wasn't even dating my daughter at the time. And then he started dating my daughter. And I'm like, oh, this is interesting. Then they moved to Winnipeg, and they helped Miller start an urban-focused Bible school, and Jordan was the dean of students there. But being the dean of students at a Bible school is one thing, but being a dean of students at a Bible school that is in a neighborhood probably worse and more difficult than the neighborhood of the downtown east side, like, that's chops. That's like somebody I want on my team. And so I was actually afraid as dad to say, ooh, come with me, come with me, come with me. You know, you don't want it to be the family business, right? But as I watched and as I watched and as I prayed, it is my absolute joy to welcome Kiara and Jordan onto the team, because they have so much to give and they have so much experience at 25, 26 years old. So I want Jordan to come up and tell a little bit of his story so you can get a chance to know him in just a small way like I do.
Keith, and thank you all for having us. I was in here 7 years ago when Kiara and I first got engaged, and I got to meet a few of you, and it's cool to be back here again with my two little girls, with my wife and my father-in-law, my mother-in-law. This is a cool opportunity, a cool experience. And as Heath said, I've spent the last 4 years in downtown Winnipeg in the North End, a prolific neighborhood, well known for all types of different adversities and things. It is seen as the sister neighborhood of the downtown Eastside, actually, in a lot of ways. And just to give you a little bit of a background of like how I got there and all these types of things, first of all, I wasn't a great student at Miller. Not because I didn't have good grades, not because I didn't have a good time, but because I was probably the most restless student, at least during my time there. I could not sit still. I could not engage in a community day in and day out without being able to turn around and engage with a lost community on the things that I was learning in my classes. And so I was one of those students who just, I was ready to leave. I was ready to get out. I managed to stay for 3 years, which turned into 4 years as I was hired on as an associate, doing an apprenticeship in student life, walking alongside young men, teaching them the word, mentoring them, and pointing them to scriptures about how God wants them to live out their lives for his name's sake. And it was during this time that my wife and I were, again, thinking, what are we going to do when we leave this place? And then I got an invitation from the college, from the president, to go to Winnipeg and see if we can start an urban campus there, something that in Miller's nearly 100 years of history has never done before, specifically in student life, but also just unspecifically in kind of a vague start-up mentality, which I didn't know what that meant until after I got there. And so in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, I don't know if I'm the guy you want for this, because as much as I loved Miller, my heart beat for Miller, I was the guy that had a hard time getting with the program a lot of the time. But for reasons beyond me, or maybe that I'm aware with, they decided we would like you to go. And my wife and I were commissioned in 2020 to move, in the height of COVID, into a building on 782 Main Street. And if you're aware of the north end of Winnipeg, you may have heard stories. Maybe some of you from back in the day, going back 15, 20 years ago, remember a street corner in Winnipeg called Stab Corner. It was the literal street corner that hosted the most annual homicides in Canada for a number of years. The building that we live in is on Stab Corner. This is a building that my wife and I moved into, a church building that had been constructed for intermittent housing for people coming in and out of addictions, coming in and out of prison, a ministry that had since been abandoned and was now laying empty. And when the church heard that a Bible college was sniffing around Winnipeg looking for a potential campus building, they called us and said, "We've got space for you." And it happened to have a small family apartment in there. So my wife and I, we moved in, we were there, and I was the first one hired. We had our director, and I say I was the first one hired because he wasn't hired. He was actually a transplant from the Pambrin campus. He had my job there for 15 years as the dean of men in Pambrin. Him and his family, they moved out almost a year before we did. And I was the first person hired to come and be his partner. Again, I didn't know what that meant. The few basic opportunities they gave me was like, "You can do administration and public relations. Are you good at any of those things?" I said, "Not a chance." And they said, "That's fine. You can figure it out." And so I went. But when I first got there, I was actually just reflecting with this on the drive over here with my wife. Like, I remember getting there not really sure what I was supposed to be doing there. Like, what is my job here? What am I here for in this initial startup? I knew eventually it'd be to do student life, something I had experience in. But what was this first job that I had to do other than be an assistant, a partner? I didn't really know. And then when I got there, Peter, my boss, my friend, and our president kind of told me, "We would like you to just investigate and contextualize Miller College of the Bible, which is a well-established Bible college discipleship training place. We want you to contextualize that to the downtown of Winnipeg," which at that point, there was still lots of looming doubt. Can we even do this? Is this going to happen? Can we have a location this prolific, this dangerous, this hard? Can this be a place that parents want to send their students to? Could this be a place that students can, like, you know, have the capacity to learn the Bible in and build strong friendships and you know, build those lasting memories that college are all about? Like, is this sustainable for our cause and for our vision? And we didn't really know. And I got there, and I was kind of dropped into it, and that was one of my tasks that was given to me, is contextualize what we have done. And in my mind, I was thinking, I think this works perfectly, but how are we going to do it? How are we actually going to accomplish that? And will it be viable? Will it be sustainable? And so I spent months just living in this neighborhood, observing it. Day one, when my wife and I moved in, we saw things on that first day that neither of us had ever seen in our entire lives. It was just really, really shocking, some of the things that happened. Some were kind of funny. Some were downright horrific. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is a task. And I remember one Sunday after church, I just went for a walk as I frequently did back in those days. And I would just walk around the neighborhood, getting to know people, asking questions. And I stumbled upon a tent city, like just across the street from where I was living, actually. I could see it from our home. And I walked up, started talking to one of the guys there. And he just said, "Hey, do you want to come and sit with us and hang out for a little bit?" I was like, "Sure, that sounds fun." So we walked into the encampment area, which was kind of like an old fort with walls built up around it, made out of tarp, plywood, sheets, those kinds of things. And in the center, there was a fire pit with some mattresses laid around it and a couple of chairs or different things. And there was no roof. And snow was coming down. It's like minus 30 on a cold January Sunday afternoon. And I walk into the middle of this encampment, and all the guys are there, you know, and they start welcoming me and say, "Hey, come join us, bro, join us." And one guy, he flips over a garbage can for me to sit on. And he says, sit out, have this seat." And I'm sitting down, and I'm just listening to them do their regular chatter and observing. And it dawned on me that how is this any different than being invited into a home to interact with my neighbors and experience hospitality from them in my neighborhood? And then that's when a phrase of wording changed in my mind forever for my wife and I, and we've never gone back. See, when I got there and I told people where we were living, like, "Oh, you live with the bums. You live with the addicts. You live with the criminals. You live with the gang members. You live with the prostitutes. That's where you live." And while that is true, those people are my neighbors. And as I was sitting around this fire on this garbage can, which was the best seat in the house, I was like, these guys are loving me and showing me hospitality with whatever they have. And I felt deeply loved and cared for. And as I was staring into their faces, I wasn't staring into the face of a drug addict, a criminal, a dealer, or whatever. I don't know what their baggage was. I was staring into the face of a created being in the image of God, made to love him, made to fellowship with him, and through own personal decisions, sins, sins of others, all these different things that play into the mix, is ended up here on Main Street of Winnipeg. And I took that back to the college, and that is when I knew that we could have a viable college here. Because if I could help my students get that they are here to live missionally, to see people the way that Jesus sees them, and to study the word in that type of context as Jesus would live in and among them, I knew that we could have a place that was maybe not safe, but a place that would be a thriving, sending place for young men and women to be equipped and engaged to live missionally for Christ wherever they are. And so I'd have students coming in for years following who were terrified when they arrived. They came like, this place is overwhelming, this place is scary, like, I'm never going outside. And I said, just wait, because I guarantee if you spend every morning in the scriptures, you'll be out there. And what we see is this amazing life cycle of the believer. So when you're in the word, you're reading through the gospel, you're reading through God's love for his people, you're reading through his commandments, it pushes you to go and bring the gospel to people. It compels you to. I can't keep this to myself. I have to go and share it like a beautiful treasure that I have had the mercy and the grace of receiving. And then when you're doing that, boy, questions come your way, because I've had students coming to me just like minds blown, like, oh my goodness, I just talked to like an ex-witch or an ex-pedophile, all these types of things. I have no idea how to share the gospel with this person. I'm like, okay, go to the word, figure it out. So they're with the people drive them back to the word drives back to the people, and so on and so forth. And I see people develop a genuine love and compassion for the hardest people in Canada to love. The type of people in Canada that most people don't want to love. And I've met people in Winnipeg that won't even drive down that street because they just don't even want to see or acknowledge or face the reality that people live in these types of conditions. And I had the joy of seeing 12, then 30, and then 50 students living at 782 Main. We're learning the word of God, building each other up in fellowship, but also encouraging and pushing each other out to go and love the people. And so there are hundreds and hundreds of stories from my students, from my wife and I. Just one particular, maybe just one that I'll share. I was trying to think of like what is something that I could share today that would kind of help encapsulate some of my own personal experience, because I had two roles. I was the dean. I was there to teach. I was there to mentor. I was there to disciple the guys. But in being in the neighborhood, I also believe that my wife and I were called to be a presence in the community to disciple. And so I did that. Our church was in that neighborhood where I was discipling guys. I was a volunteer at the UGM, discipling the men there, doing their drop-ins. And so we believe that this was our equal calling into this context. It was not just to be here to serve Miller, but to serve the people of the North End. And I remember there's one gentleman in particular. He was a First Nations gentleman, and as I learned as a tradition, what they would do is to have kind of like a seance, or not a seance, sorry, it's the wrong word, but a send-off to their loved ones when they die is to have what they would call a fire of life in their culture, and they would have a fire that would have to burn for 48 hours, and during that time, they're remembering this loved one and all this. And so in my parking lot, I saw that they had set up tents, they set up this fire and this big gathering. I was like, okay, I'm going to go figure out what that's all about. Because I was also the kind of the building manager security guy, so it's my job to check in on the property and make sure that everyone's doing things right. And I find out that this guy, Andrew, his son was killed. He wasn't just killed, he was murdered in a gang initiation. And then I found out that Andrew, this young man's dad, was there, and he saw it happen. He was on the other side of the street, Main Street. He saw his son murdered. And he ran over, and his son died in his arms before paramedics could arrive. And this guy is living in my parking lot now, mourning his son. And the days turn into weeks, weeks turn into months. And as I spent time with him, his health, his physical state, his emotional state just deteriorated as time went on, because he was just more and more going to the bottle. And I kept thinking to myself, what would I do in his situation too? And every time I talked to him, he was less there, less cohesive, less coherent. And I remember one day I was sitting on my front step, like I was reading the word, I don't know what I was doing, and I saw him kind of stumbling around in our big open parking lot. And he had no shoes on, almost no clothes, and he was just wearing underwear. And he's just drunk and stumbling in the parking lot. And so I ushered him over. I helped him. I got him to sit down. And I remember he put his hands on both sides of my face, and he just brought my face up to his face. And the only thing he really said was he was a beautiful boy. He was too young. And in my mind, I'm like, I have such an open door to share the gospel with this guy. And I had on and off over the summer. But in this moment, I was like, what do I do? What do I say? But then I started looking not just to the internal needs of this man, but the external needs. And I was looking at his physical appearance, and like he's living in my parking lot. Man has not showered, he has not bathed, he's not been clothed. He's covered in dirt, he's covered in blood, he's covered in his own filth. And I was like, I said something to this effect. I don't remember word for word because it was many years ago. But I said, Andrew, I serve the Lord Jesus Christ who came into the world to forgive the world of its sins. And in doing so, he washes us clean of all unrighteousness, of all our filth, of all our hurt, of all our pain. Can I clean you? And he kind of just nodded. And I went and I got a basin with hot, soapy water and a cloth. And together, we just slowly and surely, just little bit by little bit, started cleaning off his body. And I could see mud, filth, grime just being washed away. And beneath, just clean skin reappearing for the first time in who knows how long. And I'm watching this man just being physically cleansed. And it was such a beautiful picture of what Christ came to do for our internal needs, to take away the sins of the world. I don't know where Andrew is at today. That day I invited him to receive not just the physical washing, but the spiritual internal washing, the washing he truly needed. I invited him to receive it that day. And I don't know where he's been. I saw him like 2 years later at a barbecue in a person's backyard. I was so excited to see he was alive and that he was kind of generally back on track with things. But I still pray for him and many, many others just like him. And as hard as it actually was to leave the north end of Winnipeg, Kiara and I are excited to be joining Heath and the team. We always knew that we'd be going back to BC. I told the college I want to help with the startup, but I don't know if I'm the guy for long, long term. But the 4 years that we had there was truly impactful. God used it not just to help us to lead and equip people for inner city missions, but also to ourselves be trained up and equipped for inner city missions. Not for strategy, not for seeing statistic problems and all these things. How are we going to fix this problem? How are we going to, you know, correct this giant, overwhelming sea of problems that we see? But to get down on the street and just meet people where they're at individually. I thought about the song that we sang, Come As You Are. And I've looked at lots of guys in their worst possible moment. I've even looked in their eyes as the police are on their way to arrest this person. And they're looking at me like, can Jesus really forgive me? Can Jesus really save me? I've said, yeah. And I've said to those guys, in those moments, he can save you right now. Your prerequisite is to have faith in the perfect work of Jesus Christ, nothing more. And so it's been a joy to share notes with Heath, what him and Mariko have been doing, and just to have that mutual encouragement of very similar stories in the downtown east side. And so we're excited to be joining them in the coming days. But anyways, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. I'd like to close just reading a little bit of Acts chapter 14. And then I'll pray, because I know you've all been patient and you're probably all hot and sweaty. This is another one of those little texts that's gotten under my skin. Acts chapter 14, starting at verse 1. Now in Iconium, they entered into the Jewish synagogue and spoke in such a way that a great number of both Jews and Greeks believed. But the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brothers. And then I love this. So they remained for a long time. And so this is my prayer for all of us this morning. They were speaking boldly for the Lord, who bore witness to the word of his grace, granting the signs and wonders to be done by their hands. I get the joy and the privilege to see signs and wonders done in my neighborhood. My prayer for you is that you see it here in Creston. So thank you so much for everything and for this opportunity.